Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along today and tonight, and Bill Shorten makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been here quite a few times before, including during his time as a union official before he entered Parliament, so we're good talent spotters at the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce Bill Shorten very briefly because he's well known. He was educated at Monash University and obtained degrees in arts and law. He did an MBA at Melbourne University. Of course, he was head of the Australian Workers Union. Then on entry to Parliament, he was Parliamentary Secretary for Disabilities, and he spoke last time Mr. Shorten addressed the Sydney Institute was on the general issue of disabilities. He was then Assistant Treasurer and Minister for Financial Services, and of course currently a Cabinet Minister and the Minister for Workplace Relations and some related matters, including superannuation. So Mr. Shorten makes a welcome return, as I said, to the Institute tonight, talking on the issue of the future of work. Bill Shorten.
Good evening, everyone, and my thanks to Jared and Anne and the team here at the Sydney Institute for providing this platform for important democratic discussion. My topic tonight is that the future of work is having a good job. And it goes like this, I think. Where once you could work in a bank at 15 and retire from that same bank in that same town at 65, this is no longer so. Where once you might go to work in a bike shop at 14 and be at work in your own bike shop at 85, this is no longer so. Where once you could study Renaissance painting at university and be lecturing on it still on your own campus at 65, perhaps never even travel to Europe, this is, alas, also an unlikely scenario. The world has turned and it will not turn back. It's a world in which you can expect to have four jobs in a lifetime and to live in six different houses in four different towns if you're lucky, and many, many more if you're not. A world in which the factory floor and the staff canteen and greasy big machinery and unofficial work stoppages and picket lines and the disputes in the year-long strike in the mining town, they're part of legend now, but not the future. It's been a long road to change, but here we are. In 1900, there were some 30,000 plus Knights of the Blade, or shearers, in Australia. And there were no personal trainers, not a single one. Now in 2012, there's probably about 3,000 shearers who work 9 months of the year. Yet there are 86,000 registered personal trainers. Our labour force is changing. Our economy is changing. Realigning itself into priorities which our grandparents and great-grandparents never dreamed of. I'm here this evening to promote a more energetic national conversation about the future of work in our country. The structure of our economy is indeed experiencing some historical scale of realignment. The high dollar, the terms of trade at 140-year high, the mining boom, this is unprecedented. And our lives are changing and will continue to change because of it. The big questions that these big changes prompts is, first, where will our future jobs come from? What sectors of the economy are supplying most of the new jobs, and which sectors will do so 20 years from now and beyond? Second, what will our future places of work look and feel like? Indeed, what do we want them to look like? How are we working and where are we working from? What is the nature, what is the definition, what is the spiritual description of being an employee, an employer, or something in between? And how do we get the balance right between these things and the rest of our lives on Earth? And omnipresent, the productivity question, threading its way through all these questions and answers. It will not go away. However we prod it and poke and pull faces at it, the productivity question never goes away. Australia's lagging productivity has haunted both national and state-level politics and public policy for some 10 years. This obviously includes labour productivity. It is timely, I think, to examine what is happening to our jobs, what can drive productivity at the enterprise level, and what can deliver good jobs. Jim Clifton, the chairman and CEO of Gallup, declared in 2007 that the great global dream was thus: what the whole world wants is a good job. What the whole world wants is a good job. Now, I believe it's what Australians want, now and in the future, ensuring good jobs for themselves and their families. This is a key focus of the Gillard government, because our jobs establish our relationships with each other, our families, and as Gallup observed, our relationships with our country and the whole world around us. We spend on average in our adult lives 22% of our time engaged at work. Many of us spend much longer. It's where we earn our income, shape our lifestyles, build savings for our retirement. We derive much of our self-identity and confidence from our work. We can benefit from better health and well-being at work. We form part of our relationship with government from work. We would eschew conflict and seek harmony and security at our work. It is where we build our economy, political stability, community and society, and therefore what the future will be like for our children. Yet read any paper today, and you could be forgiven for thinking that the concept of work revolves solely around an act of parliament. Like some law alone can capture all of what I've said and magically answer these questions. Now, I don't believe the conflict model of workplace relations, us versus them, you can decide who's us and who's them, accurately captures or describes a large and growing part of our future workplaces. But I do, however, believe that Australian trade unions can continue to play an essential role in the fair distribution of the wealth created in Australian workplaces. And I do believe that small business can thrive alongside big business in our nation. I can confidently predict in our future workplaces, productivity will be important, fairness will be important, engagement will be important, autonomy and empowerment will be important, respect for systemic innovation and efficiencies will be important, and that the potential of people will continue to be important. For the creation of good jobs in the future, we need to ask when and how our workplace regulation and laws and our public policies reflect or change our values and the habits of morality with which we are synchronised. This is why the Prime Minister has spoken recently about the importance of this Labor government embracing the entrepreneurial spirit and ambition of being your own boss. It is why the Treasurer is not just seeking to share the prosperity of the mining boom throughout Australia, but reducing the corporate rate to 29%. And providing small business tax breaks. On the labour side, we know we have to consider carefully how future jobs will be created and what they will look like as functioning, efficient, satisfying workplaces. It is no accident that we are called labour. The creation of good jobs in sustainable industries depends upon the creation and encouragement of the productive and creative capacity which exists in Australian workplaces. And identifying, inspiring and harnessing that productive capacity depends upon building better relationships at work and generating respect for the potential of Australian workers. Or in other words, it's about engagement. Perhaps even happiness at work. Happiness, that's a very big word. Innovation, entrepreneurship and mentoring makes a big difference to both job satisfaction and productivity. So the future of work is not as hard to predict as some might believe. Our history of work is a reliable guide. It demonstrates that our workplaces and the way we work has always been changing. And I believe that the underlying forces and trends guiding these changes for the last 40 years will simply accelerate over the next 40 years. Tonight I'd like to offer you six trends which I'm sure you probably already know. That is the increased participation in the workforce, particularly the march of women through the workforce. The second one will be the demographics of an ageing workforce. The third about where we work and how that changes. The fourth, a new industries and its intersection with new technologies. Fifth will be the working seasons of our life, the fact that we have more of them, and lifetime education. And of course, the final will be the impact of productivity and rising wages. Just briefly to the first of these forces, which I'd submit have been at work and will continue to be at work. In February this year, we found that more Australians numerically were at work than ever before in the history of our Commonwealth, some 11,440,000 people. And in fact, in 2010, contradicting the concerns of the intergenerational report in 2000, we found that our participation rate hadn't fallen, but continued to rise. It was 65.7%. Our participation rate remains well above the weighted OECD averages. Now, underpinning the participation rate has been the steady increases in the female workforce participation by around half from the mid-1970s to 59% today. This is because the discrimination and barriers against working women have declined, but they haven't disappeared over recent decades. It's because married women and mothers are returning to work in force. The availability of childcare has increased, enabling women to return sooner after having their child. And in fact, most recently, 150,000 women have subscribed to the Gillard government's paid parental leave scheme, a scheme that is fully costed, paid for, and sustainable. Yet we know much more must be done here. We must burst through the glass ceiling, which, despite this good progress, silently impedes the march of women upwards in hierarchies of many organisations. There are only 14 in every 100 board directors for the ASX 200 listed organisations who are women. This number, with a couple of increases in the last 2 years, has been effectively stalled for a past decade. The gender balance at the senior levels of management and in the boardrooms of Australia is an embarrassment. Our workplace diversity also lags for people with disabilities and Indigenous Australians and older workers seeking to re-enter the workforce. The fact that of working age people with disability, only 50 were in employment compared to 78% of those without a disability is too low. The fact that whilst the employment population ratio for working age Indigenous Australians has lifted from 36 in every 100 in 1994 to 52 in every 100 in 2008 is still also clearly too low. And the fact that we know that older workers constantly face discrimination when they seek to be re-employed and applying for work once they hit 55 also needs to be remedied. But a second fact at work is that Australians are spending more years at work or working to an older age. Longer life expectancy, better health and reward for cerebral work over brawn is favouring longer years in the workforce. Increasingly, we are witnessing the end of the idea of a fixed retirement age for many, partly because a lot of us cannot afford to give up work altogether. But looking at the generational breakdown of our workforce today, 19 in every 100 are from the internet or the millennial generation at work. Generation X, my own generation, we're 36 in every 100 workers. The baby boomers, 42 in every 100. And for want of a better generic noun, the conservatives are 3 in every 100. That's if you're 70 plus. But of course, that I'll work on that title. So we are growing older at work. And the way we change work is changing too. 3.5 million of us go to work as part-time or casual workers in Australia. It's about 28% of the workforce. 2.2 million Australians aged 15 or older are casual employees. Casual employment's more prevalent amongst women. It's also more prevalent amongst part-time employees than full-time employees. The percentage of casual employment's increased from 18% in 1990 to 26%, and it's in the mid-2000s, and it's remained around that for the time being. We are a world leader in part-time and casual work. A third trend is that where we work is changing. That is the location of our employment. There are less people in Australia working in offices now than 20 years ago. And what I, as a union man, would recognise as the traditional workplace. That is under the direct and ongoing supervision of a manager. Now, of course, 1.4 million Australians are now working full-time or part-time from home. These figures have tended to fluctuate, but that's about 1 in 8 Australians. Just ask Senator Conroy. That number will increase. It'll get much larger with the growth of fast broadband, cloud computing, internet search engines, the more extensions of mobile telecommunications and emerging knowledge engines. The development of urban infrastructure, commuting times to work, the impact of the sea change surge and our desire to live by the coast, in the balance between work and family life, are important drivers of our changing locations of work. But the current trend is also recognising that maintaining connections with your employer, colleagues and staff, the old-time idea of working face-to-face, still remains very important. That's why we see the trend of those working partially from home increasing faster than those working completely from home. And the global workforce is here in Australia, and we are over there. There are 214 million migrants in the world in 2010, and that number is likely to rise to 405 million by 2050. And we know populations are mobile. As Paul Keating would say, the mob is moving, and they'll go where the good jobs are and the good schools and the safe streets for their kids. That's why people want to come to Australia. There's been a growing shift, both in Australia and overseas also, to temporary migration programs which prop up our various industries dealing with skill shortages and labour shortages in the short term. The success of our long-term skilled migration programs reflected in an intake that's more likely to have university-level qualifications than the resident Australian population. And our skilled migrants establish for us our international networks which foster trade and knowledge sharing, research and innovation, which makes ours a more competitive and productive economy. And of course, more Australian companies are operating in overseas markets, and they often use functions in Australia to assist their service delivery abroad. Sometimes it's meant that outsourced jobs overseas hasn't always worked. Jobs can disappear and return due to unforeseen consequences. However, increasing fluidity in jobs has seen astonishing change over the last decade. We're a government confident and committed to increasing and strengthening the Australian workforce through international skills and student numbers. The fourth trend underway and continuing is the intersection of new technology and indeed the outsourcing of household activities and the rise of knowledge workers. Though employment as a percentage of GDP declines in some of our sectors, a silent revolution of growth is going on elsewhere, most notably in services. There are more and more jobs in the paraprofessional, the clerical, the hospitality and the new trade occupations. In the last 12 months to February, we've seen 60,000 extra jobs created in healthcare and social assistance. In the professional scientific and technical services, we've seen an extra 16,000 new jobs added in the past 12 months. And indeed, even financial and insurance services, we've seen growth of 15,500. But the surge of the services sector in the past 40 years is as broad-based as it is impressive. Information and communication services have become the new age, all-pervasive employment utility. IT skills are indispensable, and they can be expensive. Business skills are growing as enterprises of all types outsource both core and non-core functions to workers who support the enterprise rather than work within it. Property services and financial services have both long been on the up. Financial services in particular, benefiting from the outsourcing of transactions and investment. And of course, increasing superannuation from 9 to 12%, as we did 2 weeks ago in the Parliament, will create jobs and wealth management. Hospitality, tourism, recreation and cultural services, they're all developing as we become more flush with disposable income. Hospital and tourism growth shows that we've outsourced the kitchen. We do get out more. The sailing and the bushwalking, the theatre going and the overseas travel. It shows that we are outsourcing our leisure. We've outsourced the home doctor to health services, and we attend more preschools when we are 3 and more universities when we're over 70. Transport services employ more people now. Construction is cyclical, but civil work is growing. Environmental services are becoming more and more about testing, assessment and amelioration. And those 21st century workplaces like biotech and nanotechnology are the new age technologies which are growing in strength and glamour and will provide more and more the clever skilled jobs of tomorrow. Of course, the internet is challenging business models from retail to sport to taxation to travel. But the internet also generates jobs. ICT professionals now number nearly 250,000 in Australia, with the growth expected to increase by another 22,000 in the next 5 years. At the same time, we're also seeing the rise of business ownership, contractualism and franchising. We're seeing payment for outputs, not inputs. The ICT and the internet-savvy net generation are pushing a shift to be paid by means other than hours of work and their starting and finishing times. 19 in every 100 Australians are self-employed. Now, men are substantially more self-employed than females, and we also, it's something like 23 in every 100 men at work compared to 13 in every 100 women are self-employed. But we're also seeing at the same time as the net and changing the structures of employment relationships, the outsourcing of household activities. There is enormous growth in spending on outsourcing personal and household activities. It's a worldwide pattern, which is now such that it is likely to exceed the spending on retailing, except in motor vehicles, for the first time in 2012. And indeed, our patterns are changing. The goods from retail outcomes, including cars, now account for less than a quarter of our income expenditure, and it's heading for less than a fifth in Australian households. We know that jobs will continue to grow for knowledge workers, but the process of replacing brawn with brain, this isn't about hiring more white-coated experts, but encouraging innovation in all workers, from those operating a blast furnace, to nursing, to the farm gate. The shift to a more knowledge-based workforce can be seen in the changing occupational mix. Employment growth has seen, in the past 12 months, has seen substantial growth in many of the highest skilled occupations. Of the 20 occupations that generated the largest employment growth in the past year, all but one have a skill requirement commensurate with some form of post-school educational training. And in 9 of the top 20 growth occupations over the past year have had a skill requirement commensurate with a bachelor degree or higher. And in fact, in the last 25 years, those who have occupations commensurate with a bachelor degree have increased from 23% to 30%. The fifth of the trends, which I think is inevitable and going to continue in our future of work, is people having more working seasons and lifetime education. Very few people today have one job for 50 years, whereupon they receive a gold watch and a send-off party at the end, followed by a retirement cottage in Woi Woi with a motorboat. Generation Y will have a lot of different jobs in a lot of different industries. And what does this mean, and what does this show, this change, the more working seasons? It shows the capacity to change, the capacity to transfer skills, the capacity to learn new skills. I think this bodes well for the future changes of our future workplaces and how we work. This is a new way of working that's coming. And lifetime education and lifetime training is the new normal. We see increasing numbers each year of students at TAFE. There's 1.9 million. And at university, 1.2 million. People return to further study now, and there are more and more graduate courses in this second decade of the new millennium. The proportion of Australians who are undertaking formal studies amongst the highest in the OECD. In fact, it's only Finland, Iceland and Sweden have higher rates of adult participation in formal education. And we don't hunt whales. The final trend of our future of work will be rising wages and salaries, contributing to better standards of living and greater household incomes. Average full-time earnings in 2011 was $69,700. With the exception of mining, which is $112,000, and agricultural, retail and hospitality, which are about $50,000 or below, all of the other industries are earning within plus or minus $15,000 of $70,000 a year. There's been a 7.1% fall in average hours and a 48% increase in real wages over the past 30 years. And in the long run, our standard of living continues to rise. For instance, we are 5 times better off than 100 years ago in real terms. Household incomes are also rising. The cost of essentials, such as food and clothing, have fallen significantly as a share of our income due to productivity and being an open economy. However, not all Australian workers have shared equally in pay remuneration. That's why our Fair Work laws and the Prime Minister enabled the Social and Community Services case to be heard by Fair Work Australia, which will now result in 150,000, mostly female workers, receiving pay equity. So ladies and gentlemen, those are the trends. They've been underway and they'll be underway again tomorrow when the sun rises. So let us now look, if we can, at productivity. Productivity is the unflagging engine of our national wealth, personal income and living standards. It is all about 3 key strategies which are drivers and enablers at the enterprise level: incentives, flexibility and capability. This definition of productivity shows that workplace regulation is relevant to one of the 3 enablers, that is, flexibility of growth in our enterprises. But on its own, workplace regulation is not going to take the enterprise or the organisation too far. We should be ambitious in this country to be a high-wage, high-productivity nation, and long-term policies are required. Now, I don't have the view that unions are in competition with business. And I do have the view that productivity is a key ingredient for successful workplaces of the future. I do have the view that productivity rises in high-performance workplaces. And I do have the view that productivity falls in high-stress, low-trust workplaces. I don't have the view that productivity gains are accomplished by lower wages and longer hours. Nor do I have the view that competition is to be feared, rather as fundamental to success. Now, productivity growth in the last decade has been lower than the average of the last 30 years. Now, I don't automatically assume one general nationwide problem here. It can be useful, rather than assuming it must be due to workplace relations legislation, to identify trouble spots. Phil Reuven of Ibis World has clearly identified non-performing industries arising from the industry from the nation's 19 industry divisions that in turn house 509 individual classes that make up our $1.4 trillion of GDP annually of goods and services. We can see the top performers in the last 5 years were information, media and telecommunications, finance and insurance, retail trade and agriculture. All have benefited tangibly from technology, logistics and innovation. Amongst the disappointing industries, where these are lower than mining, with a 6% drop in productivity, utilities dropping 5.5% per annum for the last 5 years, rental hiring and real estate services, 2% decline each year for 5 years on average, hospitality, 2% decline each year on average for the last 5 years. So there are the successful sectors and the non-successful sectors. We can make generalisations here about capital expenditure yet to come. We can recognise how bushfires, floods, droughts and the high dollar have mitigated national growth. We can debate how work choices made little if any impact on productivity and how its replacement has changed this. But to simply select either cyclical or structural or terms of trade adjustment does not sufficiently explain the future of productivity across all our industries. Now, mining, for instance, it has experienced delayed benefits from huge investments, with capital surges not yet delivering the bonanza that has been the quadrupling of mineral prices. Utilities have not sufficiently invested in distribution networks and are now increasing prices. The property industry's housing prices have boomed by and large over the last 20 years, yet productivity hasn't kept pace. Hospitality has certainly been hit by the impact of the high dollar on inbound tourism and the skill shortages and the worst floods in a generation. Yet other sectors not affected by these factors still make productivity growth. Manufacturing has seen a 1.1% growth per annum despite the rise of China and the high dollar. And other sectors, including but not limited to government, have failed to systematically boost productivity without the negative impacts of some of those factors. What is certainly clear in any reasoned analysis is that it is highly doubtful that the two-year-old Fair Work Act can carry the blame for our woeful productivity performance over a decade. Nothing I've said should be taken as meaning that the review of the Fair Work Act will not generate a useful assessment for government to consider. I'm sure it will. But workforces of the future should not outsource all things and all matters of productivity to workplace regulation alone. The creation of productive capacity at enterprises includes much that is not traditionally perceived as the preserve of industrial relations. Let me offer you some examples of what's traditionally been regarded as soft, but in fact is more important to productivity than some of the hard issues which sell newspapers. Efficiency and waste. Research confirms our long-held understanding that employees believe that up to a third of their time is wasted on inefficient, time-wasting tasks. We all who've been employees hate inefficient workplaces. Fixing inefficiency in workplaces is the key to unlocking productivity. It allows buy-in from the employer and the employee. People in my experience usually know how to fix problems, but no one's ever asked them. Waste reduction delivers permanent improvements to productivity. But there's the other things which organisations can do which don't traditionally get debated in the industrial relations context. Integrating learning and work, for instance. Employers who train and retrain their employees will always get greater loyalty, and they'll always keep their staff longer on average, because employees believe that they're achieving more of their potential at these enterprises. Or that other one, valuing people's contribution in an organisation, passing the what's in it for me test. Organisations that can explain to employees where the employee fits in and a plan for each employee's future create far greater alignment between employee and employer. And perhaps this factor doesn't receive sufficient attention, it's regarded as soft, but happiness is linked to productivity. American researchers have found that employers, not surprisingly, prefer to hire happy people at the job interviews because they think they make a better contribution. I do believe individual and enterprise performance is linked to happiness. That word again. Then there's systematic innovation. The best workforces are systemically innovative. there's enormous potential for the creativity in people to be unleashed. This means prioritising innovation. Innovation should be measured in companies. Innovation should be rewarded in organisations. Enterprises should always be on the lookout for improving and innovating products and processes. The best and simplest definition of innovation I've heard is this: it's anything that gives you an edge against your competitors. Now, innovation isn't always about boffins and computer modelling and experiments and laboratories. It's about smart workplaces engaged in what they do and using creativity and teamwork to perform better. There's two final areas which don't always get in the standard list of industrial relations, which I would submit are going to drive productivity in the enterprises of the future. That's devolved decision-making. Autonomy at work always improves your morale. Employees who are masters of their job and can control their jobs and can also deliver information, and including bad news up the organisation, without fear of punishment, will always feel more engaged with their enterprise. And of course, creating healthy workplaces. Extraordinary harm is done to workplaces by poor health and safety. Safe Work Australia's most recent estimates show that $60 billion of cost is attributed annually by poor OH&S. 640,000 Australians will incur a work-related injury. I would submit that this is not soft, these analyses. It is how you get employees to commit their discretionary effort. Excessive waste, high turnover, poor OH&S, this is rarely and insufficiently measured, but it always goes to the bottom line. So what does a good job look like in the future? What are the signs of success? Again, I think Australians can already answer that question. If you stay longer in the same job, if you're more focused on what you're paid to do, if you take less sick leave, if you believe that you're achieving your potential, if you see waste and efficiency being fixed, if you believe that the business has good values, if you find your job intrinsically interesting, that is a good job, ladies and gentlemen. So in conclusion, I believe that the future of work means agreements at the enterprise level encouraging some measure of competitiveness, changing the current trend of many agreements being merely transactional. That is, they just deal principally with wages, but not enough with other content. Enterprises aspire to have an organisational culture of engagement and collegiality. Understanding that not all small workplaces of the future will want to negotiate agreements, but simply attract labour with certain simple wages arrangements. Recognising that we cannot in our workplaces of the future externalise all workforce issues. The argument that if we could just kill off all trade unions, everything would be better. The argument that if we just change the legislation, we'd be better. Simple cures for complex problems amounts to industrial relations quackery. Not all problems either can or should be solved by government regulation. And I think there's the imperative to recognise the challenge of change is hard grind in your own business. We should be rewarding innovation and learning at every level of the organisation to create a dialogue from the bottom up. Value creation can only be created, can be unleashed, with better relationships at the workplace. Again, it is good to be happy at work. We should also appreciate that encouraging diversity in the workforce is not political correctness, but it's a driver of productive capacity. Cooperation and mutuality of effort at work create more meaning and value for people and organisations rather than contest and conflict between levels of hierarchy in an enterprise. I'd submit to you tonight in the future of work that in future parliaments, workplace relations will be much more concentrated on freeing the productivity potential of collaborative workplaces rather than sterile debates about the evils of unionism or the benefits of statutory individual contracts. The parts of our manufacturing sector that will survive the current high dollar environment will do so in part because they have cooperative, engaged, specific workplace arrangements. Jobs of the future, the best jobs, will be the jobs that allow employees to have mastery of their own lives. Unions and employer associations will flourish as they align with a focus to productivity, skills, and providing workplace empowerment for employees and employers. Fair Work Australia can assist by rolling up its sleeves to actively conciliate on the occasions the conflict does occur, rather than see themselves as a tribunal of last resort. The future of work, in my belief, is about good jobs. And good jobs attract good people. Australians know this point very well. Much of what constitutes a good job, in my belief, will drive productivity at the enterprise level. Much of what improves performance, in my belief, is unrelated to the traditional battleground of industrial relations, and there are thousands of enterprises which reflect the success of that theory. And rather, the best opportunities for the creation of productive capacity occur, in my belief, through building relationships. My experience of reading newspaper columns, or some written by Gerard Henderson, or blog sites, or watching current modern affairs, visiting Tasmanian workplaces as I did yesterday, or hearing some of the debates around the office or on the sidelines at my son's soccer match, leads me to recognise there are plenty of ideas about the future of work, that Australians are already organising their lives for the future of work and for the desire of a good job and the importance of empowered workplaces. Australia is a nimble and capable economy. Australians are nimble and capable people. Perhaps getting the approach right in our future workplaces and our future lifestyles in the land of the fair go may not be as difficult as it is for some of our larger friends, some of our stricken friends and allies overseas. As George Megalogenis points out in the Australian Moment, instead of being 10 years behind the global curve, as the evidence suggests was the case prior to opening up our economy in the early 1980s, we are ahead of the game because our economy is not as cumbersome as the United States or the United Kingdom, Germany, China, Japan or the Eurozone. With the right approach, we can aspire to have the best workplaces in the world. And we can make our workplaces not just fulfilling and productive and happy, but more gung-ho than our competitors. At present, too much of our debate in industrial relations moves tiresomely back and forth along the railway branch line between the two allegedly opposing destinations of fairness at one end and flexibility at the other. What if this debate isn't linear at all? What if there's an alternative destination, an alternative sweet spot for the creation of wealth in enterprise and well-being at enterprises? I think that the only way we can take Australia to this destination is through leadership in the workplace. The leadership role required of governments is to enable the transition to the future of work, to lay the highway but not drive the bus, to provide the supporting mechanisms such as aligning education and training with work, and we're doing this. To support industries through change and look closely, be it the clean energy future or the steel or the auto industry support packages, we're doing this. It's to support people through structural adjustment. We mean jobs programs, not just income maintenance, but retraining, and we're doing this. It's about fiscal stability and bringing the budget back to surplus, and it's about tax reform, and we're doing this. It is about institutional support, more active agreement making focused on more depth of content and dispute resolution by Fair Work Australia, and this will happen. It's about infrastructure and the NBN, the construction and upgrade of road and rail and ports and bridges so business can flow, and it's happening. It's about our consistent desire to cut red tape to facilitate business. It's also about a national disability insurance scheme and aged care reform to make sure that everyone's included, and this is happening. The leadership role of government, our leadership role, is to ensure that good jobs are at the centre of everything the government does, as that list shows. Business and trade union role, leadership role, is to look within for what they can do better, rather than to shout out to blame one another. We all know that we want our children to have good jobs, be those jobs overseas or working remotely. Jobs that are more productive, jobs that provide a higher standard of living. And we support our young ones all the way through their careers by encouraging lifetime learning. And we want to encourage them to be resilient and flexible and adaptable in the jobs of tomorrow. That leadership must come in time, over time, and soon from all of us, no matter where we work, because we know the future of work is a good job. Thank you very much.
So thanks for an important talk. So we come to question discussion. Michael might help us. He's got a microphone up here. You've raised a lot of issues, but just going back to an earlier part of your talk where you spoke about the problems of older people and people with disabilities getting employment, particularly, I guess, those who don't have post-school qualifications. Now, as you know, there's a contentious issue about the unfair dismissal laws being re-established for small businesses. And the question is, do you regard that as any kind of disincentive where an employer is going to wants to take a chance with someone who's older, who's got a disability and may think, and may be not completely correct, that if they employ that person, they can't get rid of that person? Is this a matter that you've come across in your work on disabilities, or do you think it's covered in the current legislation?
I think there's a couple of propositions in what Gerard said. The first is, do the unfair dismissal laws provide a barrier to employing people with disabilities? and mature age workers. And I think the second proposition to be addressed in his question is, are there any other barriers, or is it an unfair dismissal? Just dealing with the first. We've created now a national system of industrial relations. So the pool of people covered by unfair dismissal laws has expanded significantly. When you have a look at the overall number of unfair dismissal applications, whilst they're certainly up on 2 or 3 years ago, the pool of people from which the unfair dismissal applications can be taken has also increased. So I'd submit that there is not an epidemic of unfair dismissal applications. We've got a review of the Fair Work Act, and a number of the submissions go towards whether or not there's been a particular source of causes for additional unfair dismissal applications. And I know that the panel will be looking at that matter very carefully. And I know that when they give us their report at the end of May, the government will certainly consider the recommendations they may make in this area. So one, I don't believe it's a plague or epidemic. And two, if there are any changes proposed, we'll look very carefully at that, but it'll be based on evidence. The broader question about discrimination is, I do believe that people do discriminate against you on the basis of age, and I do believe in Australia people do discriminate against on the basis of their impairment. On the impairment issue, because someone has an impairment, that's one attribute of their personality. A person's made up of many attributes, and the inability of some to look beyond the impairment to the whole person, to me, doesn't reflect on the job seeker, it reflects on the potential hirer. Having said that, I don't think it's always conscious, and so I do think the government's got an obligation to work with employers to demonstrate that if you hire someone in a wheelchair, it's not contagious. That if someone has an episodic mental illness, again, it's not automatically catching. So I do think that we've got a role in myth-busting and also working closely with the employers to help them find the people. There's a lot of employers of goodwill who would employ people with a disability, but there's a bit of a mismatch sometimes between the service provider, that's the person who has the list of people with disabilities, and the employer. So I do think we can improve the connections there. Sometimes it's two different railway gauges meeting at the border. In terms of older people, the reason why I say there's discrimination is because I know it. What I would say there again is simply this. We're going to have to change our attitudes because we're living longer. And to use a related area, I met with the insurance industry as late as last week and said, travel insurance or workers' comp insurance or income protection insurance. A lot of these cut out at 65. And if you want to get, say, travel insurance for if you're 75, there's a lot of price gouging, in my opinion. For lost baggage, it doesn't matter how old you are when you travel to Heathrow, it's a problem. And if the volcano erupts in Chile, that's got nothing to do with your age. So I do think that there are a whole lot of low-hanging fruit to tackle in terms of age discrimination. I also say as this government has abolished the standard that once you hit 70, you could no longer be paid superannuation as an employee. We've got rid of that. So there'll be an extra 40,000 people able to receive superannuation and still working. We increase the retirement age, but income protection insurance policies offered by superannuation funds, which receive favourable tax treatment, haven't lifted to 67 and 70. So there's a lot we can do to send positive signals. But again, why do you want to miss out on, there was Frank is in a wheelchair, Stephen has trouble communicating, and Leo's deaf, so you probably wouldn't give him a job. But, of course, that's Beethoven, couldn't hear. Frank's, of course, the President of the United States, and Stephen Hawking's is splitting objects, which we haven't even seen.
Thanks. There's a question before, down there, Michael. But as usual, we'll take questions on the topic, and we'll take questions from our membership base. Yeah.
Hi, Bill. Stefan Chodowski. Thank you for your talk. The question I had was about one of the more dramatic workplace relations issues over the last year, which is the Qantas situation, which on the one hand, people might characterize as being badly managed and perhaps brutish behavior on the part of management, recalcitrant labor, and quite damaging for Australia's economy, perhaps even reputation of the brand. Yet, on the other hand, as a result of that behavior, there seems to have been a way forward that had been blocked for a long time. I'm just wondering, with the perspectives of hindsight, from where you sit then, and looking for the future, what lessons you might take from what happened there, based on your philosophy.
When we came into this building tonight, and you come down to here, you can take the stairs if you like, or you could take an escalator, or you could even take the lift. Qantas just chose to climb the north face of Mount Everest to resolve that dispute. I don't accept the proposition that what's happened couldn't have happened by another mechanism. You can do things the hard way or the easy way. And there might be some in Qantas who think that it's a sign of some sort of corporate machismo to have grounded the airline. I don't accept that was necessary. I also have, it doesn't mean that I, the government's position was all action should stop once that happened, including the union, so we were even-handed. But I don't accept it was necessary to do it without warning. I don't accept it was necessary to strand an uncounted yet number of unaccompanied minors all over Australia. And I don't think it was necessary to have staff stuck in Honolulu, not able to get home to their families at the end of their roster, because there was some fear that somehow if they had given notice that people would sabotage the planes. Like, that argument was never sufficiently made. That doesn't mean that Qantas weren't frustrated. That doesn't mean that every claim that was put up by the aeronautical licensed mechanical engineers was correct. I get that. I just don't accept that it needed to be done without notice. So, more generally about Qantas, they're a very clever company and they're a lot of very clever executives, before I get my angry phone call from Qantas, what I just said. But I also get that they've got 30,000 employees, and I don't think the morale of the employees is that good. And I live in an electorate which has a lot of airline people. A lot of these people are terribly proud of the logo, they're terribly proud of working at Qantas, and it's a good job. Qantas is a good job. But you've got to be careful you don't damage the morale of your own people. People have got to think that you've got a long-term view of them. So there's a lot of dedicated people working at Qantas right through the organisation. And just as I've never believed in stupid union militancy, I don't believe in stupid militancy, no matter if the person's earning $5 million a year or $100,000 a year. There's always a better way to fix these things, in my experience.
Just going on from that point, though, I was at a lunch the other day, Catherine Livingston from Telstra was addressing a group of women, and she spoke about how government is sort of the tortoise and business needs to be the hare, and that there is a disconnect between the way government sees business and business needs to do business. And in the Qantas strike, it seemed to me, or the Qantas matter, it seemed to me that if we'd gone down the path you've just described, the company would be bleeding to death while we waited for a nice soft solution. And in fact, the CEO of the organisation took the stand he did because he was at his wit's end as to how he was going to do business in a climate where we constantly had to arbitrate. How would you like to respond?
Well, I take that as a comment. I don't agree. No, well, I don't agree. I actually think when you're paid that much money, you're paid to be smart and not to do over your customers. Sorry, I just don't agree. And I also know Qantas after bargaining for 10 years in a previous life. And I know that there's a better way to do business. I just do. And also I'd say, for as much as Qantas has attracted attention, and it certainly did, I don't see a whole lot of other companies rushing out to emulate that style of management. So I don't agree.
Now there's a question here, Michael.
Yeah. And one of the problems in Australian education, we had a lot of disputes last night in discussion on Insight on trying to make education in Australia equal, or as good as possible for everybody. It seemed to me the one issue they would not discuss, it didn't come up, and as a person who's taught in private school and government schools, that one of the major differences in that in private schools, you can sack teachers who are not up to it, and in government schools it's extremely difficult. And it seems to me the aim of education should be looking for the best for the child, more than anything else.
I think there's a bit more on the state authority here around the Commonwealth government, but it's a question of dismissing teachers who that you can do in private schools is very difficult to do in government schools.
Well, I go back to first principles. You fire as you hire. Like, by the time you've got to firing a teacher, there's some people who are just hopeless, and I get that. I'm not a sort of orphanage for the lost. I get that sometimes you've got to sack people. There's nothing wrong with that. I employed hundreds of people for the best part of a decade, and periodically you'd have to terminate someone. But what I found is that I never had an unfair dismissal application because you fire as you hire. If you're clear with people about your expectations with them and you properly manage them, you've pretty much got an idea in the first 12 months when someone's on probation or 6 months how they're going. Now, in large instrumentalities, people become numbers. For me, you raised the issue of being able to be terminated with ease in government schools. Teachers can get fired in government schools. What frustrates me, though, and sometimes in workplace regulation, it's always easy to go to the the lowest common denominator. I think a bigger question for me in government schools is, no matter how hard some principals and senior teachers work in our government education system around Australia, in country schools hundreds of kilometres from the city, they'll never earn more than $80,000 or $90,000. No matter how many lives they touch affirmatively, no matter how much they deliver, they're stuck. So I think that in education, if we want to look at the labour relations of education, we can't just look at the firing mechanisms without how you don't burn out the young ones, you don't leave them frustrated and under-resourced, you don't, you've got to have a system where you reward the highly performing teachers, and we've got to get over this cringe that somehow if you're a public servant, you should only ever be paid a pittance for your job. So I think there's a lot in there. I'm not disagreeing with some of your contention. I guess I'm saying that for me, the thing which upsets me most about education for teachers and labour relations and teacher support is not how easy it is to fire them, but it's how they hit a glass ceiling on wages every time. And in Australia, whilst we don't like to pay taxes and we think that the taxes we pay could be more efficiently spent, it does seem to me that our teachers, by and large, are a remarkably good bargain for what we pay them.
Question. Just while we get into it, just talk very briefly, since you were last here, you spoke on disabilities. You've seemed to, you're now not the minister responsible, but you're a cabinet minister with an interest. Just talk through very briefly through how that's proceeding.
Jenny Macklin's the Minister for Disability Reform, and she and the Prime Minister and the Treasurer are leading an approach which we talked about in the first term of government, which I got interested in, was a national disability insurance scheme. My presumption is with disability that the biggest problems you have with disability is not your impairments. The fact is you're poor and no one listens to you. You're poor and you're powerless. So in the first term we asked the Productivity Commission to say, is it feasible to come up with a solution which would empower hundreds of thousands of people with profound disabilities and their carers, many of whom are adults with ageing parents, and is it possible to provide them with greater resources in an insurance-style approach where people get packages of funding, their case managed through an insurance commission, like we have in a couple of the jurisdictions on motor vehicle third-party no-fault schemes. Because what the Productivity Commission came back with a report last year is that they said, and they said this in two volumes and thousands of pages, but I'd put it like this. They said this idea that the well that you lean over and tip a coin into, which has traditionally been the view of disability, no matter how much money you put into disability, the coin will never hit the bottom. It's an unfathomable need. And that whilst we regard carers as saints and martyrs, and we don't know how they do it, it's too expensive. What the Productivity Commission said is that there's a flaw to that well. You can actually fund it if you're prepared to spend the money and get the scheme right. And so now it's at the stage where the government is working with the states, to the extent that we do, on the design of a national disability insurance scheme. The Prime Minister's made it very clear, as have senior ministers, they think this is something which needs to be done sooner rather than later. I regard it as not unrealistic. The idea of providing consumers with packages of support and their families. A family caring for someone with pretty intense or extreme autism will make a $40,000 package go further than any number of well-meaning public servants or charities ever will. So I think it is a good idea. I rate it with superannuation, the minimum wage, the age pension, Medicare, as being something which turns people from being queuing up for crisis relief, and you've got to wait till you're totally in a disaster before you can get funded, to people with managed lives, which they can control themselves. So I think it'll happen.
Thanks. There's a question there.
Minister, I'd like to ask you about capabilities and competencies for the future of work you talked about. If you look at most large organisations, particularly those in the commercial not-for-profit world, candidates for CEO or senior executive generally have a proven track record in running large teams and usually an expertise in the political side of government, but still an expertise base seems to be much more limited.
No, that's an assumption.
Can we be cut a bit short? Yeah.
So could you tell me how you think we may be able to increase that expertise in terms of leadership and experience in running large organisations, whether it be for
government
or for a board?
Yep.
Oh, we'd vote for more Labor candidates. Okay. Well, I would say that, wouldn't I? Just a bit of an assumption there about politicians being dumber than CEOs, and you didn't use that word, but you didn't say those words, I just had a sense that we're not as qualified to do what we do as CEOs are. I don't accept that proposition. Again, I can only refer to myself, and whilst having three tertiary degrees, two bachelors and a master's, having run a large trade union, which some would say disqualifies me from doing anything else, having employed hundreds of people, negotiated thousands of agreements, including a lot which generate productivity, and having sat on the boards of investment funds, I think being a politician, you know, qualified. That doesn't mean I'm qualified to make judgments about same-sex marriage. That doesn't mean I'm qualified to make judgments about a whole lot of things that I deal with as a legislator. But being a member of parliament is more than being just having a particular skill set in large organisations. And I think a lot of MPs are actually more skilled than the press would give you credit for. Also, what I would say on the other side of the ledger with Australian management is if that's working so well, why are only 14 in every 100 directors of ASX companies women? Like, I can't believe 86% of the brain power of Australian corporate life rests in men. So I don't think that the current system is automatically throwing up the best talent in the private sector. So I think that you do need... I do think, though, in a more positive note, that we do need to have a leadership university. I do think that there should be a degree in leadership. Some people shake their head, the old-timers, and kick a stone around with their boot and say, nah, you're born with it, son, you're born with it. Well, no, you're not. I think a lot of people are born with a lot of skills. The question is how they develop. So I do think that I've met a lot of natural generals on the workplace floor who, because they're wearing the overalls and because their mum and dad, they weren't born in different circumstances, never got to run the business. But frankly, they could run the business. That's why education is so transformative. So I think lifelong learning, I think... recognising that leadership is embedded at every level of an organisation. I think the conscious training of leaders, and not just those who apply to do an MBA at a business school, but there are a lot of leaders around us here now. Without knowing the backstories of the rest of this audience here, I reckon there are people who lead in their community groups. There are people who might lead in their church groups. There are people who might... You know, I think leadership, having witnessed it, is coaching an under-10 soccer team. Now, I wouldn't necessarily have picked these people to do it, because I'm a politician and they're something else, but I couldn't coach an under-10 soccer team, and I'm not making light of that. I'm saying leadership comes in all shapes and packages, and I'm saying that I think that the conscious training and promotion of leadership, as opposed to a skill set being a dentist, a doctor, an engineer, a lawyer, or whatever, I think there is an art to leadership which can be trained in people, and we do need a Bachelor of Leadership in our society. I just think that's right. There are skill sets which can benefit from, which would benefit from that development of that doctrine.
I think that's probably a good and appropriate, we've been invaded here, time to conclude, because we're approaching 7 o'clock where we always finish, so look, I'll just be very brief as usual. Bill Shorten's been here on a number of occasions. On every occasion he's been here, he's given an important address that's had a significant impact, and I'm very pleased he was here today. He raised a whole lot of issues across work and productivity, and took some questions also across a range of different issues. So we're very grateful you came here tonight. We look forward to publishing your paper in the Sydney Papers online. It'll be up on your talk will be up on our podcast tomorrow. You've done some very significant work in disability, among other areas, but that's an area which you've addressed here in the past, and I think it's appropriate that we should record it. It's a very important area for virtually for all Australians, and it's some achievement. And you've spoken up well for politicians. I think there are a lot of very bright and able ones, and I think you're one of them. So well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.